News, I'm Brian Clark. U.S. Central Command says Navy ships shot down 15 drones that were posing an imminent threat to coalition shipping in the Red Sea. Meanwhile, there's major threats to the region, according to ABC's Tom Sufi Burge in Tel Aviv.
With no deal on a ceasefire,
peaceful prayers outside the walls, amid fears for what the future may hold.
Hamas calling on worshippers to march on Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Tensions flaring ahead of Friday prayers.
The first shipment of aid has departed Cyprus, headed for the pier that President Biden ordered built in Gaza to get more aid into the territory. President travels to Georgia today. So does former President Donald Trump. They both hold campaign rallies. What caused the National Guard helicopter to crash near the U.S.-Mexico border is still under investigation. Two Guard soldiers and a Border Patrol agent were killed. This is ABC News. A United flight skid off the taxiway while landing in Houston on Friday. Another had to make an emergency landing in Los Angeles because of hydraulic failure. ABC News contributor John Nance, a former commercial pilot, says these incidents are high profile but still rare.
We have about 100,000 commercial airline flights over the planet every day, and we have about 32,000 over the United States. And for it to be as safe as it is and very seldom have anything to report on, but it's really one of the more astounding achievements of mankind in the past 100 years.
Next month marks the 25th anniversary of the Columbine school shooting. A law enforcement bulletin obtained by ABC News is warning police nationwide to be on alert because there is a concern that the Columbine anniversary could prompt would-be attackers to commit copycat shootings. This comes weeks after a teenager was arrested in California, accused of plotting a Columbine-inspired attack on his school. I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
The John and Gordy Show.
People don't realize there used to be radio schools.
It was a night school, and my very first day, I walk up the stairs, and there in the lobby is my instructor. He's laying on the couch, his arm over his head, and he's going, "Oh, my God, I wish I had gotten into real estate." That was the encouragement I got right away.
Weekday morning, 6 until 8, on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX, and on the Civic Media app. Matt Nair on air.
Hovde, Eric Hovde now. He will be running against Tammy Baldwin.
He's not a Wisconsinite. He threw his hat in the ring from California. This is Tim Michaels all over again. Businessman who walks in, goes, "Well, I can take care of this." And Wisconsin says, "No. Good to know you. Here's some Kringle. Go back home."
Is that how we politely blow people off now? Is to take a Kringle and go away.
Matt Nair on air. Weekdays at 11 on Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Americans lost more money to scams and fraud than ever before last year. $10 billion, according to the Federal Trade Commission. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
Consumer education and awareness of scams is an ongoing challenge. Scammers are constantly changing their tactics and using AI and other technology to bait more people. Judy Dollison of the Better Business Bureau says scams are increasingly complex and overlapping and often involve emotional and psychological manipulation.
We're seeing a crossover between romance scams and crypto scams because now instead of the romance scammers just asking for money, they're asking their victims to invest in crypto exchanges, which aren't real.
Dollison says 80% of people who've reported losing money to investment scams involving cryptocurrency lost on average more than $3,000. For adults ages 18 to 44, employment scams are the top risk, with an average loss of around $2,000. Consumers who suspect they've been victims of fraud can file a report with the Federal Trade Commission. Federal Trade Commission attorney Phil DeBanate says, aside from software scams, the second most reported scam involves imposters.
There are those scammers pretending to be the government. There are scammers pretending to be a well-known business or a bank's fraud department or a family member who needs help.
Common imposter cons include people pretending to be affiliated with government agencies like the IRS or Social Security Administration, charity-related scams, and tech support scams. This is Nadia Ramlagan. This story was produced in association with Media in the Public Interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Hey everybody, Todd Allball here. Noon to 2 on Monday will help you recover from daylight saving time and take a look back at the happenings from the weekend right here on the Civic Media Radio Network.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs near 41. Northwest winds gusting 20 to 25 miles per hour. Mostly clear tonight, mid-20s. Sunshine and a high near 47 on your Sunday. For Monday, sunny, breezy, and we push to 61. That's WMDX weather.
It's 34 at our studios.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates with Dom and Crute. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6.
I like your stories and your reporting. Great show.
Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Hey.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week. Here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. This is Jim Santel. This is the second hour of our discussion on this Saturday morning, and we are delighted to have you with me and with Johnny, also my excellent producer here in the studios of Civic Media, right now coming to you from the studios of WAUK in downtown Waukesha, but broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin. And inviting, as always, your comments, your questions, your inquiries, especially at a special number this morning. That number is 414-441-2941. In our first hour, we spent a lot of time doing a deep dive, kind of a microscopic review of what the Supreme Court did, its decision, this major decision, not surprising, to find that Colorado cannot keep Donald Trump off the primary ballot, providing in direction and instruction, if you will, for all of us about what Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does and does not say, some internal dissent, if you will, even though agreement on the ultimate result about the lack of state authority to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. A lot of justices, at least four of them, saying that the Supreme Court's opinion is much too narrow, much too broad, rather, and that they did not have to go in that area. A much narrower approach would have been appropriate. This hour, we're going to be doing a similar, deeper dive, a little bit more microscopic analysis of two other things, two other cases pending out there. We know that in Manhattan, the next trial scheduled, it begins on March 25th, just a few days from now. That is the so-called Manhattan catch and kill. That's the case involving allegations that Donald Trump engaged in an effort to undermine and to violate New York law when it came to handling financial records, paying off people to be quiet about his affairs and things in his personal life that would have impacted the presidential election. We're talking about what it is that the government, Alvin Bragg, the DA, is going to present there, kind of a deep dive in what that case is going to look like if indeed it goes to trial on March 25th. And then also in this hour, we're going to do a similar deep dive, some microscopic analysis of where that Mar-a-Lago case stands. What's going on right now? What are the motions that are pending in front of Eileen Cannon? What do they say? What does the defense say? What do the prosecutors say? Where is that case in terms of its status, and what should we expect down the road? But before we do all of that, again, an ambitious agenda for this hour as well. Before we do that, we are going to take at least one caller right now. Joe, delighted to have you with me this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Thanks, Jim. I think that this microscopic detail into one court case is really fascinating, and I'm looking forward to your analysis of other cases that come up. It's really a great way to go to just really dive in head first. So I wanted to just talk about one element that came up in the last hour, and that was the language used by Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett.
Yes.
She used the language that she felt it was important to, quote, turn down the turn down the temperature of the national scene, if you will. And you responded that this was a rather fascinating thing for her to say. I think that's very generous of you to use such gracious language. I would say that it's not part of their purview at all to be concerned about the national temperature. And I would argue that the insertion of that and the fact that other justices did not respond to it, or more in particular, that that Roberts did not respond to this, is really not good, because it's taking what the justices do. It's commenting and saying that taking what the justices do, we won't do anything to rock the boat, which, of course, is horsepucky, because she was signed on to Dobbs, which clearly rocked the boat. That was 50 years of established precedent that went right out the window, and she was happy with that. So what you are getting to is, you know, who decides what's volatile times? Who decides how it's turned down? Who decides, you know, when we can comment in that way on cases? And I think it's an incredibly bad precedent. And I mean, obviously she's an idiot for bringing it up, but I am just amazed that, you know, that the Chief Justice did not look at that and say, no, don't put that in there. That's not what we do. Because what does that say as we're coming around the bend to some very major cases, such as the immunity case coming up? Well, times are really volatile, so we won't do anything that we're supposed to do with the immunity case. We'll just try to turn the temperature down. That's not your job.
It is not.
The job of you is to look. Yeah, so I'd be curious to hear a little bit more reaction from you on what this might portend, since it wasn't slapped down by the Supreme Court, you know, the Chief Justice, to sort of say this isn't our job. It really looked juvenile to me, and it really looked like mommy says, you know, kids should behave. Well, that's not your purview either. So excuse me for being rather blunt, and I appreciate your more judicious way of saying it, but I'd be curious to how those comments, what that might portend as we're looking at this immunity case, for example.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot, Jim. I appreciate it.
Show, as always, appreciate your comments, and I concur in all of that. As I indicated in our first hour, these are things for the legislature to take care of, right? These are things that the people we send to the House of Representatives, United States Senate, should they be concerned about the atmosphere of the nation? Yes, they should. And they should be passing legislation that addresses those kinds of things in the areas of law enforcement and academics and commerce and agriculture and environment, all those kinds of things. They should be concerned, and they should be reactive to what's going on there. Likewise, the president, even governors in the state systems, should be attentive to and responsive to the concerns, the atmosphere, as Amy Coney Barrett described it, as Joe, you've invoked it, the temperature of the constituency. Those are the branches of government that decide these things. And I think you make a great point, Joe. Beyond just the impropriety under a constitutional structure, what is the precedent that this sets in terms of at least her approach to the future when it comes to these other major cases? Fisher deciding whether or not half of the case involving Donald Trump should be tried down the road, whether or not he has immunity. Those are things that are also raising or lowering the temperature of the population generally. Judges decide what the law is, and they apply that law to the facts of the case. And I used in the last hour the example of Brown versus Board of Education. A controversial, you bet it was controversial back in 1954 when the Supreme Court reversed decades, arguably our entire nation's understanding about education, the notion that separate school systems, separate institutions are inherently unequal when it comes to race. That was huge. Was the Supreme Court concerned? Sure they were, because they're members of our government and they're part of our national representative way in which we do government, if you will. Is it appropriate for them to have that concern that they themselves individually might have? Should that animate the decision about what the law says? Absolutely not. And so you get a 9-0 opinion in that case. I agree with you, Joe. This kind of language does not only open the door for her, but others to say, well, gee, if that's the role of the Supreme Court, what does the Congress do then? What is the role of the executive branch? They shouldn't be in that business. And to your point about the lack of any comment from either the other three, who again took umbrage with, took objection to the decision of the majority to indicate that only the Congress can interpret the Constitution in this area, and also the majority itself, the Chief Justice. There's a paragraph at the very end of the per curiam decision in which the Chief Justice, arguably, assuming that he was the one who at least put his imprimatur on this language, he talks about the opinions written by the others. He says, so far as we can tell, that is Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan, Ketanji Brown Jackson, and Amy Coney Barrett, as far as we can tell, they object only to our taking into account the distinctive way Section 3 works and the fact that Section 3 vests in Congress the power to enforce it. Those are not the only reasons the state lacked power, but they're important ones. So he does respond to what he anticipates is coming in the next pages, and this goes to how it is these cases are decided. All of them know. All of them know what they have said. And that's why in so many of these cases, whether there are concurring opinions, dissenting opinions, you get arguments right on the page. You get concurrences that say, I agree with this portion of our overall opinion, but I reach it in a different result. You get dissents that say, you know what? The majority is completely wrong. And it is as if they are arguing on the page about the very merits of the case in front of them. That happens all the time. You see that a little bit here when Amy Coney Barrett is chastising others about their language. And you see John Roberts also saying, you know what? All of you four have failed to understand the breadth of our decision. And the point that you make, Joe, is they've got the capacity to do that. Nobody responded to Amy Coney Barrett saying, you know what, Associate Justice Barrett, you have your right to have your views on this. And yes, indeed, you can print this. It is for what it's worth. It is not the law of the case. And it will be cited down the road, but it's a concurring opinion. The law of this case, of course, is a per curiam opinion of the 5-member majority. But still, it will be invoked as a notion that the Supreme Court should, in fact, be responsive to and reactive to what's going on out there. That, as you indicate, Joe, I agree with you, is a major concern. And none of the other justices in these writings that do, in fact, go back, they exchange these back and forth before it goes to the printer and before it's released to all of us. They know what they're going to say. They had that opportunity. They did not do it. What does it portend for what's coming up in June, not just in these other cases, but in all the other cases that we have also talked about that are going to change the way in which we think about our lives? We've talked about these major gun cases that are pending, very significant, coming up in June. We've talked about these social media cases. And as I've said before, this major series of cases involving the likelihood that the United States Supreme Court is going to dropkick, get rid of this doctrine called Chevron, applying deference to agencies, acknowledging the expertise and the experience that is inside our federal agencies. It's an attack upon our agencies. We will see what the justices say in June about all those very important issues. And in many others, among the 62 cases pending before the Supreme Court right now, they should be focused upon jurisprudence. And that means they apply the law to the facts to the law, and tell us what it is. They are aware of the fact that they're living in a world, that they're living in a nation that does, in fact, respond. But that should not be animating their decisions. And plainly, Joe, as you indicated, when it came to the Dobbs decision, they had to have anticipated the kind of thing that the president, just this past week, chided them for. That is, you have unleashed something. You had to know that was happening, and you went ahead and you did it anyway. You will see what the power of voters and the power of women is in America. All of these things, all of these rule of law issues, much intertwined, much connected in the history of our nation just this past week. More of all of that coming up, more discussion, a deeper dive into other cases right after this.
Radio WMDX, Madison's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
Keeping you informed, entertained, and connected to your local community. Here's Terry Barr with the Civic Media Radio Network.
you think of when I say the blues? Turns out the Madison area is home to a longtime active group of blues music enthusiasts. Formed 30 years ago, the Madison Blues Society offers events and education for everyone. Here's Society President Steve Porter.
Blues Society is a vehicle for people to support local blues, both musical events, musical performers, just spreading the word on the blues to the younger generation, to the public in general.
Longtime Society member Sherry Davis explains why the blues means so much to her.
It moves me. It's real. It speaks to me. And I feel like it's a way I can express myself.
Learn more about the Madison Blues Society and check out some upcoming events at madisonbluessociety.org. Until next time, I'm Terry Barr.
Mad Radio, WMDX, Madison's home for the John and Gordy Show.
Back doing this morning a bit of a deeper dive, a deeper analysis into some of these things going on in our nation right now. We spent a lot of time talking about the significance of this Supreme Court case. We know that there are two more coming up, as we mentioned. We've got this immunity case going to be argued before the Supreme Court on its very last day of oral argument in April. We've got this Fisher case. It also goes to the legitimacy of the statute under which at least 100 or more people were prosecuted for the riot at the Capitol. Also the predicate for two of the four counts alleged against Donald Trump by a grand jury in the interference case that is now before Judge Chutkan ultimately, but really pending right now before the Supreme Court on whether or not this immunity issue applies. A lot of focus on those cases. A lot of focus as well on the Georgia case, which is, again, one of the four criminal cases with which Donald Trump needs to address and be involved in the future. One of the other cases, however, among that four is the so-called Manhattan case. And of all of them, this is the one that probably has the most likelihood of actually going to trial. The judge in that case, his name is Juan Merchan. He has said that he will begin picking a trial on March 25th, just a couple of weeks from right now. So that looks as if that may in fact happen. That case too will take weeks, arguably months to try, lots of things to do there. And I'm going to spend some time this morning talking about what we can anticipate. What is this case all about? Because in many ways, it is identified as people as the least serious among the cases. It's the one that has this salacious aspect to it, sort of indicating that a lot of the weighty issues of the others are not involved in this particular case. And I would object to, and I would take exception to that assessment, that this is not as significant, because in many ways it is also an election interference case. It is in many ways, as I've said in other settings here on Civic Media, it is also an origin story for Donald Trump. It's the first time that we saw him engaging in allegedly criminal conduct, not yet proven. He is presumed innocent until proven guilty. First time we see him engaging in this case in a violation of at least state law when it comes to trying to influence the election. The hush money case is arguably not just an election interference case, but also politically, one of those that Donald Trump is probably most concerned about, because on the eve of this campaign, and we're now into it, it's not just the eve anymore, we're right in the middle of the daylight here, but certainly as the race ramps up in the weeks and months ahead, the fundamental notion here is that Donald Trump falsified some business records as a part of his scheme, his plan, his design to buy the silence of a porn star to keep her from going public with claims that the two of them had an affair. And as this trial draws nearer, later this month it's going to start, it's becoming apparent that prosecutors are going to likely tell a wide-ranging story that, yes, indeed, is full of some of those tabloid details and some of those headlines. And some of those can additionally be very embarrassing, not only to Donald Trump, but to his family. We're going to talk about why it is that Alvin Bragg is going to ask the judge, Merchan, there to permit him to present evidence beyond the narrow financial transactions. The hush money case, again, being prosecuted by the DA. His name, once again, is Alvin Bragg. And it's based upon this tale of extramarital sex, these business records, political animations, all kinds of things. The basics are these. And again, it's the underpinnings for the specific allegations in the indictment that's going to trial. Again, Donald Trump presumed innocent until a jury returns a verdict, if ever, finding him guilty. The waning days of Donald Trump's first run for the White House. We know that. Porn star named Stormy Daniels threatened to reveal an affair that she says she had with him. Now, he maintains to this day this never happened. And plainly, that revelation itself would have been a scandalous event, a development that could have damaged his campaign. That's one of the theories that Alvin Bragg is promoting in his trial, which is coming up fairly soon. So according to the prosecutors, and yes, indeed, their star witness, and he's back again. His name is Michael Cohen. He is the former fixer. He himself has suffered a federal criminal conviction for lying to Congress, engaging in other federal crimes. He is going to be one of the principal, hopefully not the exclusive witness, before the jury at that time. That according to Michael Cohen, Trump arranged to buy the silence of Stormy Daniels. In so doing, employees working at the direction of Donald Trump falsified a series of invoices and checks and ledger entries to cover what was really going on here. So on that fundamental basis, Alvin Bragg has recently asked the judge, again, his name is Juan Merchan, who's presiding over this trial, to tell this much broader story about what actually happened here, and saying it's not just the single secret payoff, but actually three of them at the time. They also want to relate in detail how Donald Trump used his ties to the publisher of a supermarket tabloid to stop these embarrassing accounts about him from ever seeing the light of day. He's going to talk about that as well. And that is known as the catch and kill process. Catching the story inside the journalistic world, killing it so that no one sees it. Alvin Bragg intends to present that story as well. And as if that's weren't enough, we're also going to hear, again, we've seen a lot of this before. It's going to come all back, all resurrected in this trial. Prosecutors, Alvin Bragg, also want to introduce evidence about the infamous, remember this, the Access Hollywood tape. And that's the tape that surfaced in the very closing weeks of the 2016 campaign and captured, again, this salacious conversation, this conversation from years earlier when Donald Trump spoke very openly, brazenly, obscenely about grabbing female body parts without permission. I'm not going to describe the specific language there. You know, regrettably, that is now regrettably in the history and in the annals of campaign history in America. But that was the Access Hollywood tape, and we're going to hear about that again because it's a part of this broader story that Alvin Bragg is going to tell beyond just the specific financial transaction. Now, you may ask, well, gee, how do you get to do this? Well, all kinds of circumstances where prosecutors, including me in the 30 years that I did criminal prosecution, also civil litigation, have the capacity, with judicial permission by the court, to present evidence that provides context, provides support, provides the jury with analysis of the central charge. And so Bragg wants the jury to hear about the hush money given also to a woman named Karen McDougal, who is a former Playboy model, who also claims that she had an affair with Donald Trump. Again, a similar event. Now, usually under the evidence rules, you can't introduce specific events to suggest that the behavior that you're charged with in a particular case is similar to what you've done in the past, suggesting that because you did it before, you did it again here. That fundamental notion is basically contrary to the evidence rules, but all kinds of ways with argument to the judge and permission by the presiding judge to get that information in. If indeed it is relevant to the jury's understanding, provides evidence that gives them some context for it and helps them to explain it overall. That McDougal payment between Trump and Michael Cohen was apparently captured on an audio that was recorded by Donald Trump. All of that from the DA. He also wants to tell the jury about a payment reportedly made to a fellow named Dino Sajdin, Sajudin. He's a former doorman at the Trump Tower in New York, to keep the doorman, from going public with an apparently baseless allegation that Trump had fathered an out-of-wedlock child. That's also going to be a part of the presentation. When we come back, more of what we can anticipate in the trial coming up later this month in a state court in Manhattan. ¶¶
city where the official bird is the plastic pink flamingo. This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. U.S. Central Command says Navy ships shot down 15 drones that were posing an imminent threat to coalition shipping in the Red Sea. Meanwhile, there's major threats to the region, according to ABC's Tom Sufi Burge in Tel Aviv.
With no deal on a ceasefire, peaceful prayers outside the walls, amid fears for what the future may hold. Hamas calling on worshippers to march on Jerusalem's Al-Aqsa Mosque. Tensions flaring ahead of Friday prayers.
The first shipment of aid has departed Cyprus, headed for the pier that President Biden ordered built in Gaza to get more aid into the territory. President travels to Georgia today. So does former President Donald Trump. They both hold campaign rallies. What caused the National Guard helicopter to crash near the U.S.-Mexico border is still under investigation. Two Guard soldiers and a Border Patrol agent were killed. This is ABC News.
The Bucks lose in L.A. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Lakers were without LeBron James due to a sore ankle, but still managed to beat the Bucks 123-122. Milwaukee's Damian Lillard's shot blocked at the buzzer. Coverage on ESPN.
He'll come off a Giannis screen and get it near midcourt with 5 seconds. Lillard, step back, blocked by Dinwiddie. Loose ball, game over. Huge win for the Lakers without James. So now two straight losses for the Bucks after winning 6 in a row out of the All-Star break.
College hockey. The Badgers men's team fell 3-1 to Ohio State in the Big Ten tournament. Game 2 tonight, 6 p.m. at the Kohl Center. Up in Minnesota, the Badgers women's team with a win over the Gophers 4-3 in overtime.
Now a wraparound attempt. Rebound attempt. They score! And it's Lacey Eden winning it for Wisconsin in overtime.
Coverage on the Big Ten Network with sports. I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. For today, mostly sunny, highs near 41. Northwest winds gusting 20 to 25 miles per hour. Mostly clear tonight, mid-20s. Sunshine and a high near 47 on your Sunday. For Monday, sunny, breezy, and we push to 61. That's WMDX weather.
It's 34 at our studios.
Is your computer so slow you can hardly use it? Does it have blue screens, malware, viruses, reboots, hardware crashes? Sound familiar? Computers will have problems, and when they do, you need the computer experts at Madison Computer Works. Every day, we help home users and businesses keep their computers and networks running smoothly. For solutions to your computer problems, call the pros at 231-8000, and we'll turn this into this. Madison Computer Works. Computers that work for you.
Tons of glass artists share the same passion for eye-catching art as Ignite Glass and Gifts, so we're showcasing their work alongside our talented local artists and our in-house Ignite artists. The latest techniques, the hottest colors, and mind-blowing designs are here for you to enjoy. Madison's favorite for glass, gifts, and vape, Ignite Glass and Gifts, Monona Drive, Williamson Street, and O'Dana Road, plus IgniteGlassandGifts.com. Do your eyes a favor and see this stuff.
Imagine getting ahead of your irritable bowel syndrome with constipation or IBS-C by treating it with Linzess. Then you could start proactively managing your constipation with belly pain and get ahead of your symptoms. Talk to your doctor about Linzess, linaclotide. Linzess is a prescription medicine that treats IBS-C in adults. It's not a laxative. It's a once-daily pill that helps you get ahead of your symptoms. It's proven to help you have more frequent and complete bowel movements and helps relieve overall abdominal symptoms, belly pain, discomfort, and bloating. These symptoms were studied in combination, not individually.
Do not give Linzess to children less than 2. It may harm them. Do not take Linzess if you have a bowel blockage. Get immediate help if you develop unusual or severe stomach pain, especially with bloody or black stools. The most common side effect is diarrhea, sometimes severe. If it's severe, stop taking Linzess and call your doctor right away. Other side effects include gas, stomach area pain, and swelling.
Imagine, what could relief from IBS-C mean for you? Talk to your doctor and say yes to Linzess. Learn more at Linzess.com or call 1-800-LINZESS.
Broadcasting from Civic Media Global Headquarters on State Street, this is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX.
continuing Saturday morning discussion of all things government and law and the aspiration for justice in America. We're chatting right now. You're doing a deeper dive into this trial that probably will start on March 25th in a state courtroom in Manhattan. This is the so-called hush money case. This is, as I've described it before, is one of the four criminal trials pending against Donald Trump. It may well be. It may well be that is the only trial among the four actually to go to trial before the election on November 5th of this year. And so it's significant that on March 25th, Juan Merchan, the judge, has indicated he's going to begin jury selection in this case. And between the today's date and the date of that jury selection, the judge is going to be wrestling with hearing arguments from the attorneys in connection with various motions, various requests that they're all making. And we're talking now about those requests, those motions, those petitions made in this case by the prosecutor about the extent to which the evidence will include things beyond the narrow specifics in the indictment, including the payment of monies to Stormy Daniels. And so, among other things, as I indicated right before our discussion break, Alvin Bragg intends to tell the jury about this payment reportedly made to a former doorman. And the allegation itself apparently is unfounded. But nonetheless, it provides insight into Donald Trump's approach to anything that would be contrary to his best interest publicly. This doorman apparently came forward with, again, a baseless allegation that Trump had somehow fathered an out-of-wedlock child with one of his housekeepers. Unfounded, but nonetheless, Donald Trump apparently, it makes a payment to him to keep him quiet as well. And the purpose of all of this additional language, all of this additional evidence being told about the circumstances, is to provide the necessary background to the jury and to clarify fundamentally what we've always talked about in connection with criminal cases, and that is the motive and the intent as Election Day 2016 was approaching. What did Donald Trump intend to do in all of these instances? What was the overall scheme? What was his motive? He was trying, according to the prosecutors, to keep this information from the public domain because he felt strongly that it would have an impact upon voters going to the polling booths, would diminish the chances that he could be elected to the presidency. And so he does all of these things, according to Alvin Bragg, in support of this overall approach that reveals his intent to do this. Now, not surprisingly, Donald Trump's lawyers are pushing back hard on this, and they have asked Judge Merchan to keep Alvin Bragg from making any arguments that Donald Trump was seeking in any way to influence the election by squelching, by suppressing any of these negative stories. And significantly, in an effort to reframe the case entirely, which defense attorneys can do, that's a part of the process, to offer a different set of understandings to the fact-finding jury, the attorneys for Donald Trump will probably say that he wasn't committing fraud by making hush money payments, but was instead merely seeking to prevent adverse publicity about himself from getting out. What was his motive? It wasn't about the campaign, they will say. It was instead simply to prevent this adverse publicity about him as a businessman, as an individual, from getting out in the public domain. They will go on to say, as they have already in some of their motion papers, candidates are not required to disclose everything about their personal life during an election, and attempts by a candidate, this is what the defense attorneys are saying, to keep certain matters personal are neither inappropriate nor illegal. And it's on that basis that the attorneys for Donald Trump will ask Judge Merchan, contrary to what Alvin Bragg has asked, to keep all of this additional evidence, this qualifying, this context-providing evidence from the jury's view during the course of this. And, of course, the other portion of this, as I indicated at the start, is that the exposure of all of this, once again, the Access Hollywood tape, the McDougal aspect of this, the doorman, all of this, but comes back, not new in the public domain generally, but reminding people once again, as we have not heard since 2016 and 2017, and even some of the years after that, this is all now going to come back, underscoring once again this notion that Donald Trump had a personal life that was and is salacious. That is also going to be impact, and also the reason why defense attorneys are going to be arguing strongly to Judge Merchan about not permitting this evidence to come in. These are all pretrial motions. All these kinds of things need to be decided between now and the start of the trial. They can also be raised, of course, during the pendency of the case itself. The attorneys can raise objections based upon relevance and focus. But the judges traditionally will make determinations about these large bodies of evidence in advance of the trial, not only so that everybody knows how long they will take, but that there are no surprises coming up during the course of the trial. You don't want to have a jury suddenly suspended in its review of the evidence. If you, in the middle of a trial as the judge, need to resolve this major issue, judges tend to do that in advance of the trial. That's what Judge Merchan is going to be doing between now and the start of the trial on March 25th. A small footnote to that, and that is that we'll always wait to see. But when the first juror is impaneled there, if this case is really going to trial, as we have seen in all of these other cases indicted, charged about a year ago, none of them probably going to trial this year, anticipate that the March 25th trial will go ahead, but one never knows. All kinds of things can happen. Motions can be filed that for various reasons interrupt the natural flow of cases going to trial. Less likely now that that will happen here, but we'll wait to see. We'll wait to anticipate the empanelment of that jury sometime after the case is called on March 25th and evidence is presented in April and in May and arguably into the summertime as well. So we talked about motions. We talked about this fact that the attorneys for both sides have this opportunity in advance of the trial to submit what are called pre-trial motions. They have pre-trial conferences, pre-trial hearings, and indeed, that's also what is going on right now in the so-called Mar-a-Lago case. This, again, is the case in which the special prosecutor Jack Smith has alleged, again, in an indictment coming from a grand jury in Florida, that Donald Trump not only took but also retained, used, bandied about some of these documents, some of them classified, not all of them, to which he had no entitlement. And the status of the case right now is that although Eileen Cannon, presiding over this matter, did in fact have a hearing a little more than a week ago, anticipated at that time perhaps setting a trial date for that, she disappointed a lot of people by saying, you know what, I'm not going to issue a decision on that right now. Previously, she said that that case will go to trial on May 20th. The charges in that case were first filed in June of last year. That date will almost certainly slip. And although it's right now still on the calendar, she has not told us with specificity what that new date may be. But what she is doing is she is entertaining these pretrial motions, just like in the Alvin Bragg case in Manhattan, the so-called hush money, the catch and kill case. She likewise is entertaining motions that are going to define the landscape, the geography of that trial, the Mar-a-Lago case, the documents case, whenever it goes to trial, which could be later this year, more likely sometime in 2025 after the November election. So what are those motions all about? Well, here's the big one. It has to do with selective prosecution. Selective prosecution. Prosecutors in this case, in the Mar-a-Lago case, are pushing back on the notion that this was involved in any way with a decision to prosecute Donald Trump selectively and differently from others who are similarly situated. How does this come about? The defendant in this case, the principal defendant, not the only defendant, but the principal defendant, Donald Trump, saying that he's a victim of selective prosecution and saying that he was being treated more harshly than President Biden was in an investigation into his handling of sensitive materials. And we've talked about that recently. The prosecutors, Jack Smith, have said recently that the evidence of potential wrongdoing against Donald Trump in the Mar-a-Lago case is, in their words, starkly different in two major ways. Very different from the decision not to prosecute the current president, Joe Biden. Very different in two principal ways, that according to the special prosecutor. In an array of these motions to dismiss this case against Donald Trump, the prosecutors are going forward and saying that there are significant differences between what is going on here and the decision not to prosecute Biden. You recall that the handling of classified documents was also the subject of another special counsel, and his name, Robert Hur. He released that fairly controversial report not too long ago, finding that there is nothing here. There's no intent, there are no charges that could possibly be brought, and determining that a criminal case, cannot be made against the former president. We've also seen that the Department of Justice did the same thing with respect to the former vice president, Mike Pence. Mike Pence, likewise, the subject of an investigation in determining whether he inappropriately had classified and other documents. Similarly, the Department of Justice coming forward and saying, no indication of intent there, no reason to believe that there is a reason to conclude that there was a criminal basis, a criminal motive for those two, that is the current president and the former vice president, holding on to those documents. And so, what in particular does the prosecution say about this selective prosecution charge, this claim by which Donald Trump and his attorneys are seeking the outright dismissal of that case? Well, prosecutors working for the special counsel have again said that while there are some superficial similarities, the differences are really actually very profound. Among other things, they say this: the volume, the sensitivity, and the storage of the documents all point in the same direction. This, again, from the motion responses being filed right now in the Mar-a-Lago case. They say that Trump's conduct was much more serious than that of Joe Biden, thus confirming that the two cases are not nearly identical, as the defense states, and that there are legitimate reasons for viewing them very differently. They added this. They said Trump has not shown, that Biden's conduct, as described in the Hur report, that is a special counsel report, makes him a similarly situated comparator, that is somebody whose situation you compare one situation to the other, has not shown that Biden's conduct makes him a similarly situated comparator for purposes of a selective prosecution claim. Now, selective prosecution claims are also notoriously difficult to prove, and the defense understands that completely. And the Jack Smith folks, the prosecution, understands it as well. Because they require the defense to show the government effectively discriminated against the defendants by charging them, but not charging somebody who is similarly situated in like circumstances. Prosecutors wrote in response to this motion to dismiss the case based upon selective prosecution that Trump's decision to hold on to these dozens of these highly classified records as if they were keepsakes, memorabilia, or trophies to store them in an unsecure location and then reportedly obstruct attempts by the government to retrieve them, including through a grand jury subpoena, that all of that makes his behavior fundamentally different. And so the comparison between the Biden situation, arguably even the Mike Pence situation, we've got none of that. And the Donald Trump situation does not in the end support a selective prosecution claim, a defense to the prosecution itself. That's what the prosecutors are saying. Again, it is a heavy lift. It's a lot of burden for a defense attorney to undertake. The request by the prosecutors to reject that Donald Trump somehow has been treated unfairly is only one of several other court filings brought also by the defense as a part of this motion practice. And the prosecutor is also seeking to counter other motions to attack the law he is accused of violating. That is the underlying charge there. To question the very legality of the special counsel prosecuting him. To claim that the records he'd been charged with removing from the White House belong to him, that he had a personal interest in those. And again, that he is immune from prosecution. When we come back, we're going to talk more. We're going to unpack those a bit more as well. As part of our analysis, our deeper dive, our more microscopic view of what's going on there in that case, right here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Radio 92.7 WMDX.
This St. Patty's Day, remember the story of Lenny the Leprechaun. Lenny moved to Madison searching for a place to live.
If I find the right place, I'll find me pot of gold.
So he went online and searched up movetomadison.com.
Ooh, what riches!
Yes, Lenny, riches indeed. People that sell with the Aaron Weber Group get the best price with updated market reports and instant property value quotes, virtual or in-person meetings too. Find your pot of gold when selling with the Aaron Weber Group at First Weber.
I wish I could get this stupid jar open.
Jars can be tough, am I right?
Who are you? And how'd you get in my kitchen?
It's me, Flo, and I'm here to grant your wish of easily switching to Progressive and helping you get a discount that honors the time spent with your previous insurer.
Great, but what does that have to do with getting this jar open?
Nothing.
So you can't open this?
Oh, I just do insurance. Jars I leave to the professionals.
Sign up for Progressive and opt into more savings. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Not available in all states or situations.
Mad Radio WMDX, Madison's home for the John and Gordy Show.
Microscopic analysis of some of these big stories coming out of some of these major cases right now, talking about the Mar-a-Lago criminal prosecution. No clear trial date set, although May 20th remains arguably on the docket of the presiding judge. She has not told the attorney, she has not told us when this case will actually go to trial. It is significant in terms of its dimension, unlikely based upon the number and the series of things she's got to decide right now, that it will see the light of day before the election either. So joining probably the election interference case, probably the Georgia case, none of those going to trial. The one, once again, that may well go to trial later this month is that case in Manhattan. But in Florida, Eileen Cannon has before her these motions, one of them charging selective prosecution. Unlikely that in a merit-based analysis of that motion that a reasonable judge would grant that motion, dismiss the case. Selective prosecution, a very difficult thing to show. There are other motions also pending in front of her. Another one of those motions, the Trump legal team arguing that the charges should be dropped because of a claim that the attorney general himself, Merrick Garland, had no legitimate authority to appoint Jack Smith in the first place, and that prosecutors working for him have no legitimate funding. And now, noting that there have been many special prosecutors appointed by attorneys general, the Supreme Court has recognized that authority explicitly in other cases. Jack Smith and the others defending against these motions have rejected that idea. They said this in their response to that motion about authority to prosecute. Each argument is incorrect, and neither supports dismissal of the charges that were properly returned by a grand jury in this district, reminding America that this case, like all the others, does not come from the desk of the attorney general, does not come from the desk of a legislator or a president, but rather from a grand jury. The Trump attorneys also argue that the case should be dismissed because a law called the Presidential Records Act, that law makes official White House files public property, somehow allows presidents, before they leave office, to designate certain materials like diaries as their own personal records. Now, we know that that's not the case, that all those records are the property of whom? They're the property and the possession interest of the people of America. They argued that Trump's sending the files to Florida indicated that he was implicitly saying these are owned by me, and that there was no second guessing, if you will, of any of this because he understood those to be within his personal ambit to do this sort of thing. Of course, Jack Smith, once again, pushing back upon that fairly preposterous invocation of the law in this case as well, and saying that all of these claims rest on three fundamental errors, all of which, according to the documents, reflect the view that as a former president, the nation's laws and principles of accountability that govern every other citizen do not apply to him. In other words, discriminating between his situation and that is invoked with respect to any other defendant in court. Final motions out there, the Trump team arguing that, again, he's absolutely immune from prosecution because this traces back to his time in the presidency. And that, of course, brings us back to what's happening before the United States Supreme Court. Interesting argument there. They may be arguing that, in part, the taking of the documents from the White House happened while he was still the president, and therefore he's immune for that purpose. But undeniably, the great majority of the allegations, if not all of them, read clearly and dispositively, make it clear that the allegations happened after he was outside of the presidency. And so on that basis alone, Judge Eileen Cannon has a sufficient basis upon which to deny that motion alone. And that would even assume, of course, that presidential immunity is such a thing. That is what the United States Supreme Court is going to be hearing argument on the last day of its oral argument in April. That is what the Supreme Court is going to be telling us all about sometime in June. That could indeed animate the decision on this immunity claim also now being raised in Mar-a-Lago in the documents case as well. Lots of motions pending there. Of course, Eileen Cannon also, as we've discussed before, has these issues about how to handle the national security documents. How do you handle those cases when classified documents are presented in a public forum, which is a federal court? All kinds of things have got to be addressed in a pretrial setting. Also have to deal very centrally with this other issue, which we've talked about a lot, and that the special counsel is very animated about, which is the disclosure of information about witnesses. The special counsel has said that Donald Trump has had this history, and indeed he has, in other cases, including this one, of intimidating witnesses, of threatening them explicitly and implicitly, and that that process has prompted a violation, if you will, of the fundamental ways in which we try cases. It affects the jury process. It affects the jury pool. It affects the ways in which witnesses in particular are inclined to testify. And if indeed the notion goes, information is disclosed in the public domain about who those witnesses may be and where they are located, their home addresses, other identifying information, they too can be subject to threats, inappropriate threats, illegal threats by people, including people in the Trump ambit. And that will have an impact upon the administration of justice in this trial. If indeed they're chilled from testifying, if they're prevented from doing the kinds of things that we'd expect a witness to do, which is to testify honestly, completely, without fear of intimidation. That matter is also pending in front of Judge Cannon. She had begun to go down a road, pulled back after the special counsel indicated that some of her analysis was somewhat flawed. All of this needs to be taken care of, of course, before there is any trial that is opened, conducted with respect to the charges against Donald Trump. Again, broad charges, but significant in that they once again are dependent upon showings of intent and motive and purpose. And that's why the special counsel is pushing back on all of this that indicated that Donald Trump did not have the intent, did not have the motive, did not have the purpose when he took these documents out of the White House, nor did he have that criminal intent when he used them, moved them around, engaged in other things that were contrary and are contrary to the law as set forth in that indictment. Lots and lots to take on. Lots and lots to consider when it comes to the status of all of these cases. This morning, spending a bit more time, as we are going to be doing in future broadcasts as well, a bit more time diving more deeply into the nuts and bolts of these cases, a more microscopic look at the rule of law here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Join us again next Saturday for more of this analysis, analyzing the significant news events of the week in the areas of law and government and the aspiration for justice. Have a good week, everybody.
On air at 92.7 megahertz frequency modulation
and streaming worldwide on the Civic Media app.
This is Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX. Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 11 till noon on the talk you can't ignore. Mad Radio 92.7 WMDX and on the Civic Media app.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
You're listening to Mad Radio.
WMDX 1580 AM Columbus. W224 EG Madison.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. U.S. Central Command says the latest airdrop of humanitarian supplies to Gaza, including